Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I'm Ron Edwards. Co-host Don Allen is en route. Hopefully he will join us in a very short period of time. Just a lot going on here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, if you will. We hope we're coming through loud and clear, because there is a lot that is out there. We were hoping Mr. Allen would be here with us by now, so that we could open our phone lines. We have a suspicion that there's a lot of opinions out there right now in regards to a situation involving, again, the MPD and the 4th Precinct in North Minneapolis. And it comes at a time of heightened violence, anxiety, concern, fear, and et cetera, with the significant, almost unprecedented number of shootings, not homicides, but shootings where people are being shot just since the 1st of January here in our beloved city of Minneapolis. We've had about 103 to 104 people shot, gun battles in the middle of the streets, if you will. We received a couple of calls from a couple of individuals who observed hostilities, as we would refer to it, going on. Now, this has led to a situation in which the former commander or inspector of the 4th Precinct has been relieved of duty. A press release from the MPD yesterday indicated that Mike Thesaven had been put on paid administrative leave to attend to personal problems, if you will. Now, there are certainly a lot of rumors that are swirling about the city, swirling about the public safety, law enforcement community, and et cetera. It comes on the heels of an article in today's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune by a resident, a man by the name of Daniel Fields, who raised questions about the mission, if you will, and commitment of the powers to be in the city of Minneapolis to deal with the quality of life, the sense of fear, and et cetera. So we, as a journalist, commentator, historian, have been talking about that for a long time. Maybe it's one of those situations where, you know, somebody other than a black person who far too frequently are the victims of this mayhem, make a declaration, make a statement, make an observation, and have an understanding of what is going on, because we disproportionately suffer the consequences of this mayhem, these shootings, if you will. As we said before, probably about 103 to 104 shootings since the 1st of January. Gunfire everywhere at all hours. A couple people were telling me how, you know, as an example, they heard gunshots at around 6:45 or something to 7 as little children waited for their buses and et cetera. You know what I'm saying? We are looking at shootings, as we said, at all hours of the evening. And so this raises questions and places demands on all institutions. You know, what is going to be the corrective action, the solutions, the resolution, and et cetera, and et cetera. And I'm just not sure, as a long, long-time observer, that is necessary in place. But there are specific entities that are totally obligated and responsible to have a plan and to provide the necessary safety. And, of course, that is law enforcement. And by the way, it's not just the MPD. You see, we've not had the kind of discussion in our community that there are other entities out there. The county, if you will, the state of Minnesota, and the federal government have special units that are very much involved and are supposedly committed to the public safety, if you will. In fact, we have at least 4 so-called shooting teams, if you will, that are operating just in the city of Minneapolis and primarily on the north side. two of them with the MPD. One is a shooting team headed up by a couple of officers who allegedly have significant experience, expertise in the SEPRA. And then we have our, the Gang Intelligence Unit, which is comprised of officers who are supposed to be extremely proficient in the area of detecting gang activities, guns, et cetera, et cetera. Then we have the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department had a special unit that had been deployed in North Minneapolis under the leadership of a Lieutenant Pat King, Patrick King, formerly of the Minneapolis Police Department. And then, of course, you have the federal authority. You have the ATF, DEA. You have, you have Homeland Security and et cetera, because they're also looking for the possibility of activities and actions by those who also may be involved in the area of terrorism and et cetera, if you know what we mean. And so all of this is at play. And some of these things have come up during just the last 48 hours. As we said yesterday, probably around 9 o'clock in the morning or et cetera, the announcement was made that Inspector Fleece Haven had been relieved of duty. Inspector or Commander Jose, who previously was in that position before Mike was appointed to that position, has been returned to the 4th Precinct. In fact, he was on the scene, according to reliable sources, of a shooting, a lot of gunfire on Glenwood, right in front of the Minneapolis, one of the Minneapolis fire stations, the fire station right there on Glenwood. Morgan Irving, right around in that area, gunfire, a lot of shots fired, et cetera. But then, as we said before, that has become commonplace. And so that is leading to people raising questions. We understand that this afternoon, a delegation, a small delegation of about, 11, 12, 13 people, came before the Public Safety Committee under the chairmanship of Long Yang, Democrat 5th Ward, City of Minneapolis. Council President Barb Johnson also sits on that Public Safety Committee. The folks were raising questions about the removal of the inspector of the 4th Precinct. They were asking for questions. We are somewhat puzzled because the chief does have a community advisory group. I've not really heard anything from them. I know that the chief is working diligently and has been for quite some time to encourage and develop a plan, but, you know, it's tough to do it. And we're not supposed to say this, if you will, but we're going to say it because that's the way that we are cut, if you will. That's been our history as a journalist, a activist, commentator, historian, et cetera, is that there seems to be some unhappiness in the ranks of police officers across the city, but particularly in the 4th Precinct, who have decided that they maybe need not put together a significant effort, if you will, to deal with the, and it's not perceived violence, my friends. There is significant violence. In fact, in my column in the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder for this for next week, I talk in terms that there is a war in the streets of our cities here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so as we see this violence continue to escalate and et cetera, we just have to continue to ask the question just how safe is our community, how safe are our children, if you will, how safe are we, quote unquote. A lot of people come into the city of Minneapolis for work and other kinds of obligations and et cetera, and certainly they're being confronted with the level of violence, but it is the people that live in the city of Minneapolis, be it first the north side, secondly South Minneapolis, that are the ones that have to duck the bullets, try to escape from the knives, if you will, from the beatings and et cetera. And it is not healthy. This is a city that is priding itself about, you know, its economic continued upturn, construction downtown, construction in the more genteel areas of the city, if you will, big events coming with the opening of the Viking Stadium on July 1 or thereabouts, a facility with allegedly 32%, 34% of the workforce were people of color. Sometimes people get confused and say African-Americans and et cetera. As we said on this program, as I've said in my columns and et cetera for the last 3 years, all that's untrue. There was nothing approaching 32% of people of color working on the what is now identified as the U.S. Bank Stadium. We have warned as a journalist and as a historian, again, that all of this was guaranteeing, when we say this, the continued ignoring of the African-American community as a vital and effective workforce, if you will, particularly with our younger folks, that this was a guarantee that we were going to return to the days of the hot summers that at one point led to this city in the early 1990s being referred to as Murdapolis, if you will, only because of the presence of significant professional triages, if you will, hospitals, in other words, North Memorial, HCMC, Abbott, Fairview. I mean, all of these hospitals, which are in are locally in close proximity to the fire zones, if you will, to the danger zones, to the hot zones, and et cetera, that we probably would have 50% more fatalities if it were not for these triage centers. But we are now at a point of extreme danger in these communities. These young people, and rightly so, do not see or hear, but more importantly, they don't see a plan which talks in terms of how they will, quote-unquote, be given opportunity to get out of the quagmire, the quicksand that they have been dumped into, if you will. As we speak, there are people who are talking in terms of negotiations that are going on at the state capitol, dealing with opportunities or attempted opportunities, if you will. We're not sure that any of that is happening. We're not sure if any of that is even in the scheme of things, if you will. What we need to do, because we are looking at possibility, we're having some technical difficulties, it may be, I'm not totally sure. I thought Mr. Allen would be with us by then. By now, I need a signal from one of our listeners on text message or et cetera that they can hear this broadcast, if you will, because sometimes in the last couple programs we run into some technical difficulties. But right now we're taking a look at a controversy that is going on, that is being talked about in the city, that surrounds the commander of the precinct, if you will, and we're just not sure that all the facts are going to be presented and sent out to a community that that needs, well, really needs to know, needs to have a indication that things are working. Again, we are waiting for our associate, Mr. Allen, to join us. He appears to be or should be en route. But again, I need some kind of signal because I do not see on my console that we are broadcasting per se. I saw some lights go out. So I'm going to wait and see if I receive the appropriate signal that we are still airborne, if you will, and that folks are hearing this broadcast and what is happening. Again, I'm attempting to get any kind of text message or et cetera that this is what is going on. We've heard a text message right now. Let us, we don't want to disconnect. So I'm hoping that Mr. Allen is getting ready to come in. As I said, we wanted to get him in so that we can get our phone lines open. We want to hear from some folks in regards to that. All right, we have... We have a signal that we are loud and clear, but we're having some difficulties at this particular point, which I'm not comfortable with. And then that's not good because we want to give you, our listening audience, all of the professional information and et cetera that we need to have. And because the situation at the fort is extremely serious, and it is quite clear that there are some questions that need to be asked, and there are some answers that need to be given to a population that is extremely concerned about the safety, if you will, of their children, their loved ones, and et cetera. And we're just not sure what is happening with that. Let me also say that we would be remiss if we did not send our prayers and best wishes, and certainly are hoping that there is a fairly quick apprehension and arrest of some individual extremely sick who attempted to sexually molest a 5-year-old baby as she waited on the bus after being dropped off by her mother. Child brutally assaulted and injured, if you will, broad daylight around 8:05 a.m. Monday morning. And it's just totally outrageous, frightening, if you will, and something certainly on this side of the river needs to be said to our friends and colleagues on the east side of the river, that we just hope that the individual who unfortunately was identified as a black male is apprehended as soon as possible, if you will. Again, we're hoping to get the phone lines open so that if there are any questions about this current controversy, and of course the 4th Precinct has been in the midst of a lot of controversy. Now, that also brings us to the editorial in this morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Not surprising to this columnist, if you will, and to a person who has heard and followed very, very closely, in fact, on a personal note, the circumstances surrounding the death of Jamar Clark. But the editorial in this morning's edition of the Star Tribune case that the Star Tribune Minnesota poll had been taken a sampling of 1,001 people, and that there is clearly a significant division as it pertains to the thinking of black and white folks with regards to the issue, not only of Mr. Clark, but the whole issue of fairness and equality, and equal justice for all. 68% of Caucasians feel that everything was done appropriately, that Mike Freeman handled it very, very well, if you will, and that whatever fate was dictated by the circumstances leading to the death of Mr. Clark was okay. On the other hand, 68% of African Americans vehemently disagreed and clearly indicated that it was not a good, clean investigation, if you will, and that also there's problems with the issue of equality, if you will, fairness under color of law, and et cetera. And the Star Tribune goes on to say in this morning's editorial that this is shocking and should be of concern. Well, you know, we in the black community have been saying that for a long, long time. In fact, well, remember as a very, 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 very young man hearing my community, and I'm talking about now back in the early 1950s. I mean, you know, we have been saying this for a long time, that this is not the liberal enclave that everybody attempts to pretend that we are, if you will, that there are significant problems predicated on race, and that if we are not able to address those things, that there is going to be problems. Now, I heard these kinds of discussion when I was a high school student here in the city of Minneapolis, going to Minneapolis Vocational. We're talking now 1954, 55, 56. And it's one of the reasons I became very much involved in the social action agendas of the mid-1950s, because, you know, I witnessed with my own eyes the imbalance, if you will, the discrimination, the racism, and et cetera. But I guess it becomes a kind of annual affair that institutions, if you will, such as white newspapers and et cetera, speak to the revelations as if it's something new, when in fact it is not. I think there are many of us in the African-American community who have been asked 4 months ago, what do you think the results would be if a survey was commissioned and to ask the question about how blacks and whites felt about equality and justice and et cetera. And many folks, old and young, if you will, would have given numbers and estimations pretty close to what the Star Tribune's poll, the Minnesota poll, would have shown. And so it is on that particular note that I think it is important for those of us who bring that experience and that knowledge and that history to the table, that we be bold enough, aggressive enough, honest enough to say that it's nothing new for the black community, okay? These descriptions of how we view each other and how the African-American community and others are treated is nothing new. You know, it is not something that just came here from another planet, if you will, or emerged after an asteroid or a comet passed this planet, if you will. It is not a part of that and anything that even approaches that. That then means that we cannot continue as a society and in this city make excuses on why it is that we can't seem to correct this problem. Now, the governor has been talking about this whole issue of diversity. You know, it used to be known as civil rights. It was known as affirmative action and such things as that. But it's really, in the words of a Spike Lee movie, if you will, it's just do the right thing. You know what I'm saying? And so it's now really reached the point, particularly with the response of groups like Black Lives Matter and others, and particularly with high-profile fatalities, which is not new for a person such as myself, who has been in the struggle for close to 60 years, if you will. Well, it has been 60 years because we started becoming involved as high school students with regards to what was going on, the kind of policies that existed in our community, such as African-Americans going to North High School as an example, that no more than one African-American up until around 1955, 56, no more than one Negro could start in football and basketball. And you really weren't encouraged to play baseball. It was a little bit different in track and field because there's too many brothers that could run fast and jump the hurdles and high jump and et cetera. It was difficult to keep them out, but you still were left with the feeling that you really weren't wanted, if you will. That was at North High School, and there were a lot of liberals who went through North High School, white liberals who went through North High School and came out and allegedly became the voice, quote-unquote, of fairness and doctrine and, you know, participated in the development of documents and ordinances and statutes and et cetera. I used to always wonder what their role really was during the height of the segregation and nullification and reversal here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so, as it pertains to the article in the Star Tribune today, I have to say, I in good conscience could not play the game and say that, oh my God, I'm shocked. This is, oh, I believe this. And go talk to white liberal friends and et cetera and make it appear that I needed their guidance on helping me understand why this was in play, okay? That game is just what we just said. It's a game. It is a part of a level of dishonesty and disrespect to the facts of history and to the long, long, long struggle of the sons and daughters of the Africans. So no need for us to play that game. Now, this brings us to, so what are we going to try to do? It takes us back to the early part of tonight's program. You know, one of the controversies that's emerged is that there seems to be a slowdown, that a lot of white officers aren't that keen with doing anything at all. And, of course, in some cases, the few black officers that we have, some find themselves caught up in it. Others, of course, continue to stay the course. In fact, in the article this morning, there was an interesting in the editorial, and it talked in terms of getting more African-American officers on the streets, if you will, and in positions of authority and et cetera. Well, actually, the chief has done a pretty good job of putting African-Americans in significant positions of responsibility and et cetera. And if folks were really on top of that, they would kind of know that. What the problem is that these promotions are not all the time well accepted by far too many of the white rank and file. And that is one of the issues that is not being addressed, or as people like to say, that's one of the elephants in the room. In fact, there is a situation right now where it's quite clear that human resources, which is interesting enough, is headed by a black woman, if you will, who is a good friend of the black civil rights director of the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, has basically done nothing to deal with the issue of making sure that there are more African-Americans who are qualified to come into this department. In fact, the number of African-Americans in this department, the MPD, has been stagnant ever since the federal remediation agreement was lifted, has been stagnant right around 67, six the numbers it continues to be around. We really haven't made any improvement with African-American female officers, if you will. We haven't made a lot of problem with other officers, females of color. We continue to progress with white female officers, if you will. But even that number is not close to what was set down as guidelines in that period of from 2004 to 2008 by the Federal Oversight Group. Operating under the authority of the Department of Justice. And what makes it difficult is when an African-American sits in a position of power as director of human resources, if you will, and the Civil Service Commission sits there as the arbitrary body, does nothing and says nothing about it. In fact, we are actually in danger of losing one of the richest reputations that was acquired over a period of 20 years, proportionally, being the most integrated fire department in the United States. We are in danger of losing that. And one of the problems is that you never see anything from the Human Resources Department under Ms. Ferguson. You never see the Civil Service Commission. In fact, we couldn't even find the names of the three Civil Service Commissioners. There has been discussions within the Federal Oversight Group to ask the commissioners to join us in a closed session and kind of explain why it is that African Americans, male or female, are being cut out of the opportunity to be law enforcement officers for the city of Minneapolis. Now, people could play like this is a deep secret. It is not. There has been discussion. It is on the record, if you will. There is full knowledge of it, if you will. And so I'm not sure of at what point a corrective action will in fact be taken. Now, we are going to go until 9:30. I had hoped that Mr. Allen would have joined us by now. And I'm not getting any indication of he apparently is still en route, if you will, because we really would have liked to have opened the phone lines to get some observations from some of our listeners on what we just talked about just over the last 3 minutes. We intentionally put that issue out there with regards to the absence of commitment by the Human Resources Department and the Civil Service Commission as an example, which means that the City Council, who continues to talk about diversity, needs to be challenged on the sincerity, if you will, of what it is that they're saying that they're concerned about, because everyone on that 13-member City Council and in the Mayor's office knows that there is a serious obstruction within the process, within the civil service process, as an example, with getting qualified. I mean, I have been amazed at the number of qualified young African-Americans, male and female, that have been suddenly rejected. In fact, we have a white psychiatrist, if you will, who has become legendary with regards to how he has wiped out significant and qualified African-Americans just over the last year and a half, and et cetera. In fact, there was a very interesting discussion just a month and a half ago. Some corrective actions were supposed to be taken. Nothing happened. The guy's still there. In fact, this guy actually lives over in Wisconsin, making all kinds of money, just, you know, drives across the St. Croix Bridge, comes into Minneapolis and finds a way to get rid of black applicants, if you will, for the police department. As we said before, we're also in danger of losing our ranking of the most integrated fire department in the United States of America. These things are sad. Now, this then, of course, brings us back to what it is that we are able to do with regards to the expectation of our young people who have a right. Just as those of us who were young once, if you know what I mean, had a right of expectation. And, of course, I came out of an era when, quote, unquote, we made the necessary demands and took the necessary actions and we took to the streets and we took to the courts and et cetera. We've said on this program before some of the legal actions that I was a part of being involved in with young brothers and sisters of that particular era, the 1960s. Actually, we began in 1958-59 when we formed a group called PEP, People Employing People. You know, one of the first places we went down and stormed and acted, you know, crazy around was the prestigious Minneapolis club, if you will. And so there is a history of a community standing up. But, of course, I understand what has happened. If one does not receive the information, if one is not brought up to speed about what is happening, if leaders suppress information or don't know what they're talking about, if you will, and et cetera, then things like this will certainly to happen, if you will. And so, again, you know, I wish that we could have had the phone lines open, because I think there were questions out there from people about what has happened to the inspector, Fleece Haven, and what the circumstances were. We have laid out some parts of it. There are other pieces that it is only appropriate that he lays out, and that there is a decision to discuss it, if you will. We thought it was sad today, as we understand it, that his youngest daughter was there with the group to ask the question about the reputation and the legacy of her father, and she cried, if you will. She is of high school or early college age, but it was disappointing because she talked in terms that people had not reached out. I hear a lot of discussion over the last 3 days or so about how everybody loved Fritz, if you will, how they respected him, how he was working on a multiplicity of issues and et cetera. And yet when his daughter this afternoon in front of the Public Safety Committee talked in terms that no one had called, no one had reached out to this man, I just kind of wondered what kind of game was really being played. You know what I'm saying? Because clearly he early on did everything he could, himself a part of the issues and the concerns, and developed a trust with community. Now, clearly some things happened. As we said just minutes ago, a determination will have to be made by all parties on just how far they want the discussion to go. It is being said that there is a opportunity to allow him to do some things which he felt were very important to him and in his relationship with community and policing, community policing, as we like to say. Again, this is his call, if you will, and the call of those who say that they have worked closely with him and et cetera. We wrote a column, by the way, for those that are listening and raising questions, taking notes, that we wrote a column after the occupation of the 4th Precinct in which we commended him for a job well done. Well done. I think the record clearly shows that the inspector did a tremendous job. He worked very hard to keep the tensions down, to minimize the backlash, the discussions of retaliation, and et cetera. And sometimes, you know, that is a obligation that you are involved in that takes its toll on you mentally, spiritually, if you will, and et cetera. And so hopefully situations and circumstances be worked out in such a way is that this man's presence in the community, if you will, in the area of policing will continue to the extent that there is a significant level of satisfaction and that some healing can take place. Now, we have no idea if that potential is there for all sides. We would hope that it was. And we go back to what we talked about at the top of this program. There are great problems. There are tremendous problems with regard to the whole level of anticipated safety in the city of Minneapolis. St. Paul is right there with us in many regards. It is frightening. But so much of this violence is laid at the heels of those who just take for granted that actions that necessitate and bring about violence is something that is acceptable. It is not. It's just like whoever it was that attempted to deal with that and violate that 5-year-old child, that some way or another that kind of conduct is acceptable, that in some way or another one could do things and get away with it and there are not consequences, if you will. So we would hope, as it pertains to the future and the safety of our children, et cetera, that, you know, it's at some point, man, people would just understand that is not something that is acceptable. And it is difficult in some regards to talk about because one has to ask the question, I mean, how could an adult, no matter what their mental conditions may have been, could take and think about violating a 5-year-old child, a baby, if you will. It just doesn't make any sense. But I saw a piece in the New York Times just the other day that talks in terms of how this problem of mental health is beginning to catch up to this country. You remember a number of years ago when the Congress and the government cut, just went along with it, cut hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars from the mental health institutions and just took a lot of people who were in these institutions, you know, for therapy and et cetera, and just put them back out on the street, don't go on out there and do their thing. There were many who warned back then that was not the way to go, and they were absolutely correct. Now, as we said before, we think that there needs to be clarification on what will be happening with policing in the city of Minneapolis, and particularly North Minneapolis, but also South Minneapolis. There's just not enough emphasis that South Minneapolis has tremendous problems and has continued to have tremendous problems. And we ask this question again for the fourth, fifth, sixth time. We ask as long as we feel like we want to ask it. You know, what is the plan? What can be done? Starting with the economic foundation, the economic base of a community and we used this term before over the years, to be able to see down the road, down the pathway, that there is a positive vision down where the sun rises and beautiful rainbows, are created, and et cetera. Because I think there are a lot of you out there that know that young people and older people, if you will, are really feeling a serious sense of despair. They just feel that there is really no hope, that a game is being played. Now, that takes us, in the last number of minutes on this program, into the presidential contest. It appears, for all practical purposes, that it will be Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, if you will. Now, the new polls put out earlier today and right after the announcement that Ted Cruz was dropping out and the governor of Ohio was dropping out, et cetera, saying that Hillary Clinton defeat Donald Trump in a head-to-head campaign and election. And that appears to be what will be happening, because it's quite clear that there is no other candidate who has the wherewithal. When I say wherewithal, I'm talking about finances to try to run as an independent. And so this country is going to be tested over the next 5 months, if you will, with regards to just how civil we could be with each other. You know, I told some friends and associates of mine that what's basically happening, something that Malcolm said many, many, many years ago, chickens have come back home to roost. See, it was popular, it was in vogue to attack Barack Obama based on race, if you will. It was in vogue to insult him, to insult his beautiful wife, his beautiful children. It was in vogue to insult, quote unquote, the history and the lineage of African Americans, Negroes, Blacks, however, other than the NIG term. And so what really began to happen was that, Americans became comfortable with disrespect, if you will. And it is not just confined to older folks. It's what we've been talking about on this program for going on the last hour. Young people began to feel that it was okay, disrespect and et cetera was the order of the day. They gave themselves their own quote-unquote names and et cetera, the millennium and such things as that, the young people who didn't need to listen and et cetera. Well, that has its fatalness, if you will. And across the world, we are seeing a planet in which this kind of disorder, disrespect, is kind of the order of the day, if you will. And we are closer, if not already there, to the kind of conflicts, particularly religious conflicts, which then also drives racial conflicts, and we want to be involved in. And yet, let me just say how people's minds are warped right now in this country. Just earlier today, a report out of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, you have these white, because, see, one of the things we don't do in this country is that we don't talk about white crime, and white violence, and that's a little game we play. And here's a picture of a guy taken last month who went into possibly as many as 15 upscale, by the way, upscale supermarkets in the kind of central Michigan area. They're kind of going from Skaganaw down towards Flint, Port Flint, the city that has been poisoned, if you will, back down towards Ann Arbor and home of the University of Michigan, and East Lansing, and Lansing, East Lansing being the home of Michigan State University, and maybe even a little bit further down. And this guy had put together a cocktail of poison. He used a combination of rat poison, cleaning fluid, if you will, and a couple of things. And he had put it in some spray bottles. And he had been going into these stores and spraying this contamination on vegetables and fruits and et cetera. And now, you know, the government is trying to tell us that they're really not sure how many people were poisoned and have been poisoned, and allegedly there hasn't been a influx, if you will, of people going in or calling the poison centers and et cetera. I guess I would question the authenticity and the correctness of that. You got to figure a whole lot of people started having all kinds of medical and physical problems and couldn't try to figure it out. And, you know, God knows, you know, folks do not want to identify an American corporation as being responsible for your condition. That's not the way the game works. But this guy, you know, he looked like a picture being shown all day today. He looked just like your normal door resident, if you will. Went to a good white church, if you will. Probably belonged to all the right white clubs and et cetera. And would have been inconspicuous anywhere that he went. And yet he came in and he had all of his poison material with him in these little bottles and flasks and et cetera. And I thought, wow, I mean, here's a person that had no regard whatsoever for anybody's life. And then there are these other situations that take place in this country that, you know, the media goes to great lengths not to talk about. And again, we're talking in terms of white-on-white violence, if you will. And we had said to some associates and colleagues in a conference call a couple of days ago that until this nation begins to deal with white-on-white violence and stop trying to play the game that every white person who kills their family and children and et cetera or goes out and kills everybody, that it's all a mental health problem, because every time I look at and research documentation that talks in terms of African-Americans who have stepped over the line, I've never heard any significant beyond maybe 5 or 6% of any identification that the African-Americans had some kind of mental problem. You know, I've not seen all these brothers, sisters that are in the institutions and et cetera who committed a pattern of crimes just like their white counterparts are never even given that analysis. And the reason I said that also was that another article in our major white paper, and I know that many then are, you know, acceptable of that because the white media put it out there, of a brother over in St. Paul who had served 2 years for sexual misconduct, if you will, had gotten out and was trying to get his life together. And in the course of that, had become enrolled in college courses in the technical college over there in Ramsey County and was trying to get him decent housing and et cetera. But what happened was, no one paying attention to the fact that part of his conditions in terms of his probation was that he needed to go in and get therapy and et cetera, which was beyond his financial capabilities. And lo and behold, the court, the state of Minnesota, sent him back to the penitentiary because he couldn't afford to get treatment, if you will. Now, this happens at a time when the legislature is over there meeting and is talking about what it is that they want to do and how they're going to be involved in a doctrine of fairness, if you will, equal justice under law and et cetera. And I thought that if not for the newspaper account today in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, I doubt if any of them and any of our leaders knew anything about this situation, though people have been talking about it. And in fact, at one point, there was in a series of meetings that leaders had been having and putting together their proposals, one for $75 million, the other one for $33 million, that they were supposed to talk about some of these things as well as the restoration of of sentencing and et cetera, et cetera. And so we did some quick checking before we went on the air with sources, and they said this brother and actually his attorney had attempted to reach out to community leaders over there in St. Paul. Nobody would respond. Nobody was committed to do anything as it pertains to him. And so this is an African-American that's been put back in the penitentiary because he couldn't afford to get treatment. yet he had done everything else that that he needed to do. So we need to keep that in mind. We also, in the last 8-9 minutes, we're sorry that our associate, Mr. Allen, did not get a chance to join us. We are further concerned about where the Jamar Clark, we spoke earlier on tonight's program about the editorial in this morning's edition, Minneapolis Star Tribune. But we find it rather interesting that the, in fact, they celebrated Jamar Clark's birthday yesterday. His 25th, well, he would have been 25 still with us at Harrison Park in North Minneapolis. And I began to think about the fact that I really have not heard a lot about the investigation and et cetera. Now, as we all know, the feds have that investigation. There has been one extremely outstanding witness, maybe really the only witness that saw what happened and stepped forward. His name was Jerome Copeland. In fact, they tried to send Mr. Copeland back to the penitentiary for 19 months, kind of make him disappear, as we talked about in our column in the Spokesman Recorder. Mr. Copeland, a courageous African-American, is standing his ground. He has indicated that he is prepared to testify on what was attempted to be done to him to suppress his information, his eyewitness account of the death of Jamar Clark. We are aware that about a month ago, the FBI indicated to him that he was a person of interest and would be summoned before a grand jury. But we noticed that the papers are not writing anything. You know, the electronic media is really not saying anything. Every once in a while, though, somebody will mention Jamar Clark's name. But my response is to what extent and for what purpose? I mean, what do? Are you asking the questions? I just find it amazing that no one was moved or concerned about what happened to Mr. Copeland, because what happened to Mr. Copeland, if it had not been for his public defender, a white female, Ms. Bovey, Mr. Copeland would have disappeared into the criminal justice system for the next 2 years, if you will, and would never have had his statements made available to a federal grand jury. And yet, there's been nothing but silence, nothing but silence. All of our quote-unquote activists and leadership have not said anything. And in fact, most of them are too scared to reach out to Mr. Copeland, because some of them had actually, working closely with the authorities, had actually circulated information in the community that Mr. Copeland was not there on the morning of 15 November 2015. And I'm saddened by that, because I think that was calculated, if you will. It was mean-spirited, but it also undermined it, if you will, the integrity of the investigation, but also the ability to be able to develop a case, may have even helped Mike Freeman, because Mike Freeman was aware that Mr. Copeland's Q&A, question and answer, had in fact initially been extracted from the first case files that had gone over, that he then turned around and sent back when the county attorney became aware of Mr. Copeland's testimony. And by the way, on that particular note, for those of you out there that continue to talk about, you know, Mr. Copeland, what he wasn't there just because they said he was and now got themselves burnt, if you will, is that Mr. Copeland's transcript has been tampered with. And it is ironic, the portions of his transcript that were extracted, deleted, redacted, and et cetera. And so we want to keep that also in mind, because at some point, the federal government will ask the question about that information, and Mr. Copeland's transcript, which initially, you know, disappeared, was nowhere to be found, nowhere to be seen, when it should have been, if you will. So we're down to the last 4 minutes. Again, we're saddened that our co-host wasn't able to get here with us, because we really would have liked to open the phone lines. We know that there are a lot of different opinions about what happened to the past inspector of the 4th Precinct, as the supporters said this afternoon at a meeting of the Public Safety Committee of the Minneapolis City Council, that he wants to clear his name, and what that entails, only he and of course his supporters and probably the Federation, because he does hold the actual rank of lieutenant. And so we, you know, we'll be watching that closely, if you will. We think it is a continued narrative, scenario, whatever you want to, however you want to define it, that talks in terms of what the future holds for the city of Minneapolis, particularly in the area of public safety and et cetera. Oh, by the way, Michael Gore is hired, irrespective of all the attempts to malign him by the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP, has been hired as the chief executive officer of the Boys and Girls Club. Congratulations to Michael Gore. He suffered some wounding, if you will, or that was totally unnecessary at a very time when the Board of Education was about to select him as its next superintendent. I thought that was certainly ill-advised and paired and ill-delivered, if you will, but, you know, folks felt comfortable with it. We do hear a rumor. We hear that the leading contender very well could be the current commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Education, that she may very well be a person who was a former assistant superintendent who may be returning as superintendent of the district, if you will. The board, by the way, for those of you out there, has to really get itself in shape, because they're really going to have a person in place by certainly no later than the 15th of June, just as school is out, because there are so many administrative things that have to be done that you need a person of significant responsibility and authority. Last time I looked, that's called a superintendent, so that we get to hit the ground at full speed. And maybe, my friends, we could turn around this continued deterioration of the education of the African-American child and other students of color, if you will. And maybe we can help parents who have just lost total confidence in everything, the institutions and et cetera, regain some confidence that someone is actually committed to the positive and aggressive education of their children, their babies, their loved ones, and will make us a place, a better city, a better society. But we look forward to hopefully a meaningful debate as it pertains to what we are going to do in this city and also our sister city of St. Paul with regards to this violence. Also, by the way, ask your elected officials if they've ever figured out where all these guns are coming from. A lot of guns coming into the Twin Cities, if you will. I'm talking about brand new stuff. I'm not talking about some old rusty 22 or 25 or 38. I'm talking about stuff you take right out of that oil paper that they're wrapped in, if you will. Well, anyways, appreciate you being with us, and hope we provided you with food for thought. And we will be back next Wednesday, and hopefully we'll be joined by our colleague, Mr. Allen. Again, this is Ron Edwards. This is the Ron and Don program coming to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Good night.